Thanks again for everybody who's helped us open the meeting by doing the readings, and take this opportunity to welcome anybody that may have joined us since we first started. Particular welcome to any visitors to our meeting, and a massive welcome to any newcomers to NA that might be with us today. And we hope you hear something that's going to encourage you to keep coming back. So thank you. And it falls to me to introduce our speaker this evening. And yeah, I'm really pleased to say that this gentleman's agreed to share with us tonight. Started coming to our meetings a little while ago, and I always enjoy what he has to share. And to my shame, unfortunately, we keep agreeing to talk to each other and then keep missing each other and do, outside of the meeting. So I'm sure that will be rectified at some point. Without further ado, I'm going to introduce you to Barry, who's going to share his experience, strength and hope for the next 40 or 45 minutes, whatever he's comfortable with. And I do know that he passed a pretty significant milestone in recovery recently. I shall leave it to him to share that with you if he chooses. So Barry, please share with us, my friend. The floor is yours. Thank you.
Thank you,
Steve. My name is Barry, I'm an addict.
Hello, Barry.
Hi, Barry.
Hello, Barry.
It's nice to hear familiar voices. I think my eyes kind of pinged open this morning, a bit like they did yesterday, but not with it's Christmas. It was like, it's the day of the chair. Oh my God. And so had this anxiety countdown during different parts of the day where I completely sort of cut off from everything that was going on and just go into this sort of self-obsessed thing. Well, I sort of thought, and I thought, you know what? I think the best thing to do is to try and apply a spiritual principle, and that's just surrender and hand it over, you know, and trust that the God of my understanding will speak through me, because really what my job is today, it's not about me, it's about, you know, carrying the message of recovery if I can. And, you know, I'm more than sort of happy to try and do that, because that's what's happened to me. In thousands and thousands of meetings, you know, the message has been carried to me again, again, and again. And I pretty much need to hear it every meeting I go to. Like Steve said, I celebrated 32 years on Tuesday. And, you know, it's, you sort of go back on a birthday. I mean, for me, I do anyway. I'm sure people will agree. And sort of, I can remember, it's 32 years ago, what it was like getting clean. And, you know, I thought I'd go to a treatment center and I'd get off the drugs and everything would be fine, because that was the problem. I didn't understand at all that the problem was me. And I got to the treatment center and sure enough, I came off the drugs and I felt absolutely terrible. I just couldn't function. You know, my bodily functions were really bizarre. My mental facilities were just all over the place. I was getting in touch with things I'd never been in touch with. I felt sort of different to everybody in a sort of strange, sort of special and not so special way at all. And I thought, well, it's going to be fine once I get out. I just need to get out of this place and then carry on living, you know. And there'd been a couple of meetings in the treatment center, and I didn't really pay that much attention. And I did the first five steps, actually, when I read my fifth step to a guy that came into the treatment center from the local meeting from another fellowship. And I found the whole thing excruciating and uncomfortable. I didn't have any sort of peace of mind at all. I just, you know, felt so extremely different to what was being said there. And then there was the odd little moment where, for example, I can remember I was supposed to go down to group, and I couldn't go down to group because I was too afraid, basically. And so I put on like an overcoat on top of my pajamas and held the big book of NA and just clung to it for dear life, really. And someone came into me and said, what are you supposed to do? So I'm supposed to go to group. And they went, well, okay, if that's what you're supposed to do, why don't you just try doing that? And, you know, as any addict, I love drama, you know, and drama just seems to go hand in hand with addiction. And while this person was saying this to me, it was this like incredible thunderstorm and lightning and everything. And so I went down to this group, and then after the group, something shifted. So there was a difference. And someone said, "You want to go for a walk?" And I went for a walk, and suddenly it was this amazing sunny day. And the guy who'd come up to the room, one of the counselors, was walking along like a similar path. And he just nodded to me, like as if to say, "I know what's just happened to you." And I didn't quite understand it myself, but it was a glimpse of a moment of relief and a moment of release from addiction. And when I left the treatment centre, though, on the way back to London, I just felt the world kind of closing in on me. I couldn't talk about it. I couldn't tell anybody about it. I had some phone numbers from people there, and I just could not contact them. I think somebody called me, and I did the old classic sort of thing with my partner of like that miming, sort of like, you know, tell them I'm not here. Tell them, I'm not, you know, and the sort of waving the hand under the chin. I'm not here. I'm not like that, because, and then I explained that, like, oh, they've got these problems and they just want to talk, you know, all night, and it was rubbish, you know. And surely enough, I woke up the next day. About 6 o'clock in the morning, I went out to the, you know, waited for the supermarket to open and bought some alcohol to get going with. And I sat on this this park bench with a bunch of homeless people. And they were saying to me, "Are you okay, mate?" And I, you know, in my arrogance, absolute arrogance, I was like going, "What do you mean? Am I okay?" You know, and I lived in some fucking swish pad, you know, in Chelsea, which of course was mine and all the rest of it. And so I started drinking very early on and carried on through the day until I bumped into someone who I used to use with. And I said, "You know, have you got anything?" And they said, "Look, let's go over now to Shepherd's Bush." We went over to Shepherd's Bush and scored, came back, went into this public lavatory in Chelsea, World's End. And of course, I hadn't used for 2 months. So he used, and then I used. And as soon as I sort of, you know, put the drugs inside my system, I keeled over. And then, addiction being what it is, I just heard this voice go, "That's not enough." And I sort of went, wow. And I sort of managed to put another hit together, took it, and just slid down the wall. And the guy that was in with me in the cubicle just looked at me and thought, "Well, this guy's dead," and just ran off. And surely, you know, sure enough, I was gone. And I woke up in a hospital. And the story goes that they went on seeing the guy run out, the toilet attendant thought, right, well, that's it. It's the, you know, it's the end of the night. I'm closing now for Christmas. It was 22nd of December. And so he, you know, locked up, got in his car, went home. On the way home, he realized that he'd left his watch there and thought, well, I've got to go and get my watch. I'll need it over the holidays. And he went back to the toilet, saw my foot sticking out the bottom of a cubicle, and called an ambulance. In the hospital, they said to me, "What's going on? Because, you know, we sort of heard from your partner that you've been in this treatment center and you're trying to get clean and all the rest of it. Now, if you want, you know, we can give you a script for the rest of your life, because it looks like, you know, this is what, you know, you're going to need to sort of happen to you. Or you can go to NA, because your partner was also saying that you're wanting to go to these meetings that you're talking about." So I said, "All right, don't give me the script. I'll go to meetings." And for the first time in my life, for a very, very long time anyway, my head, which was constantly full of beratement, constantly full of self-hatred, constantly full of like sort of noise, really, like a sort of, you know, bad radio station. And there was voices going on all the time, backwards, forwards, all sorts, you know. I was very used to this as being the way it is, you know. And so on saying no, I'll go to meetings, it was like the volume dropped just enough for me to sort of get a sense of like something happening here that's different. And I didn't know what it was, but the fact that I, for the first time in my life, I'd refused a drug and then said, yes, I'll go and get help, was the shift, I believe. And the next day, I went to a meeting, and I'd been sort of seeing a woman, a counselor, and she was in NA, which I didn't know at the time, but she came into the meeting and sat next to me, said, how are you? You know, and I was sat there sort of like a, you know, like a rabbit in the headlights, sat on my hands, which was an indication of I didn't want to speak. And she shared that that she was really pissed off the night before because her boss at work told her she had to stay behind. And
Yeah, really, what?
she was due to get on a flight.
There's nothing.
And
Really, yeah.
sorry, Lisa, can you turn your sound off, please? Thank you. And she was due to get on a flight to New York, and the plane crashed. And she was therefore sort of talking about, you know, how obviously how grateful she was. And that wasn't the only thing that happened at me. And of course, you know, my heart goes out to people that didn't survive that crash. But in that moment, it seemed like something was happening. And the person that did the chair talked about how they'd been to treatment and they'd come out of treatment and used immediately, because I had this great shame about the fact that I'd gone there and didn't make it. And he said, you know, and he almost like told my story. And what was really, really encouraging was the fact that everybody at the meeting was sort of hugging each other and laughing and waving to each other, saying, where you go? You going for a coffee? Yeah. Well, where you go? Oh, I've got to go and get, do some Christmas shopping then. It was like, and I was like, I'd never, you know, been around this kind of energy for so long. You know, I was so used to this sort of endless junky energy, this sort of negativity. And so they said, they asked for sort of people to do stuff at the end of the meeting, and they said, can somebody sweep the floor? And for some reason, I stuck my hand up. Didn't feel like I did, but my hand shot in the air, and I swept the floor, you know. And someone came over to me and said, how are you doing? You know, it's good to have you here. Nobody said it's good to have you here for a long time. I wasn't welcome anywhere. It was like it could see people. I could see people roll their eyes and go like, "Well, fuck you. That's your problem," you know. And so I did that, and they said, "There's another meeting tonight." This guy said to me, "There's another meeting tonight. Why don't you come?" So I went to this other meeting later on. It's quite a small group, quite intense. And this girl did the chair, and she spoke incredibly eloquently on the power of negative thinking. And I was like, what? Like somebody else thought the same as me, you know, and it wasn't so alien or foreign, and I wasn't that different to this person and to these people in the rooms. And I went home after the meeting, and I remember sort of like actually making some food as opposed to just sort of like going, oh, well, that doesn't matter. You know, it was like something had shifted. I wanted what was happening here, you know. And oddly enough, not oddly enough, but sort of coincidentally enough, I guess 32 years to the day now, I went to a meeting and shared for the first time. And there was this wonderful moment when it was, you know, if you're new to meetings, you know, it's a wonderful aid when there's a part that says, this part of the meeting is now for newcomers, you know, or shy sharers, you know, and if you're new around, this time is for you. And that happened, and then there was this pause. And it was almost like this, I mean, in my self-centered brain, of course, that pause was for me to come in and say something. I could feel this sort of like energy vibe, you know, a vibration of like, this is for you, you know. And I said, my name's Barry and I'm an addict. I feel really lost. I don't know what's going on, you know, and said a few things like that. And then at the end of the meeting, people came around me and sort of gave me their phone numbers and, you know, call 24/7. And I'm like, really? you know, I thought I'll try that. No, but there was just this openness, and then you know, I decided then that this was the place for me. You know, this was the place where I can go and get help on a daily basis. And you know, so I listened to these suggestions about, you know, do 90 meetings in 90 days, and you know, look for the similarities, not the differences. Get a sponsor and start working the steps. And because it's about an inside job, it's not the drugs at all, it's you. And that started to sort of make sense to me the more meetings I went to, and I could see how sort of self-obsessed and lacking in self-acceptance I was. So I did my first round of steps there, you know, and started in on, you know, getting clean and staying clean. And I sort of heard that the first three steps were like a foundation, so that when the winds and the rain came, you wouldn't be blown off your feet, and that you should build that foundation as solid as you can. So I did this, like, so every week in at that time there was a meeting that went 1 2 3 1 2 3 1 2 3 round and round and round and round. So I started to get a gist, you know, of like what was happening. And you know, and I worked every day on accepting that I was powerless. You know, every morning, and I still do it now, first thing I do is wake up and say, I'm powerless over my addiction, my life's unmanageable, help me accept my powerlessness and manage my life for me. I still do that to this day, and it's always stood me in good stead. So I practiced that, you know, and I remember, you know, it'd get to the second step and there'd be that stuff about, you know, would it be insane for me, for someone to come up, you know, and ask me if I wanted a heart attack or something like that. I can't sort of remember it, but that there's a line about, would it be insane for me to sort of want a heart attack? And I can remember for months and months going like, maybe, well, it would seem reasonable, yeah, seem a reasonable thing, because that's how disconnected I was from any kind of sanity. But you know, I got a sponsor, and that sponsor would sort of like say amazing things to me that I'd never heard anybody else say before. Like, you know, I'd say something happened today and I feel sort of like I got through it, and they'd say, yeah, it's the small victories, right? And I go, small victories, wow. So this is what it's about. Day of the time, small victories. I think I can manage that. I think I can do that. I think I can live with this. And you know, then it was about trying to sort of live normally, you know, and I got some breaks, you know, I got some great things happen sort of early on, you know, amazing sort of, like I got a job that took me to America. And I remember around the time I was writing an 8-step, and my sponsor, and I said to my sponsor, do you think it's too early to do this stuff? And he went, no, it could be too late, actually. And you know what it's like. I'd get to America, and one of the first three people on the list is at the airport in America. And I have the chance to say to them, you know, that time I lived with you in your flat and just used all the time and took you so for granted and didn't give two, you know, didn't give a rat's about you. And he said, listen, I did hear that you were sort of trying to get well and that you were going to mean just keep on doing what you're doing. And I was like, wow, this is amazing, you know. And then I got to this office, and I had to phone up this this place to get some equipment. And I phoned this place to get some equipment, and this girl answered the phone. It was a girl I used to go out with, an American girl. And she was like, do you know who this is? I said, yes, I do. And so, and I started to do that. I was going, this is great. I can do all this men's stuff now. And I started to do this men's and making this men's. And she just went, she just said, basically, F you, you know. And I was like, hey, that's not the way it's supposed to go. I'm supposed to sort of say this stuff, and you're supposed to forgive me like that. And I called my sponsor, who was in America, and he was like laughing his ass off, you know, and going like, she saw through your spiritual bullshit, right? And I realized that, you know, there's a time and there's a place for everything, you know. And I realized that you know it is in my higher power's time, and that I just you know I don't just get this sudden sort of like reprieve from sort of like going, hey, you know, here, you know, here I am with my apologies and this sort of stuff. And it was really good for me to sort of like, you know, just sort of come back to the program rather than sort of run off with this whole thing. And I can remember at that time going to a meeting in America, and this guy going, there's the three most important words that I've learned in recovery are slow, slow, and slow. And I've really taken that on board. You know, I've taken that on board to such a place where, you know, after 32 years, I've got to tell you, there's some things now that for the first time I'm starting to get. For the first time, they're sort of seeping into my bones, into my spirit. You know, and there's been glimpses along the way, and there's been sort of, you know, and I've never been given more than I could handle, even though I thought I can't take this particular part of my journey anymore. It's worked out okay. It's worked out okay, you know, and along the way, the encouragement that I get from people, the encouragement I get from what people say, what people share, it's just unbelievable, you know. I hear things and I remember them. You know, I heard someone at a convention saying that addiction doesn't eat, doesn't sleep, just talks. And I remember that every day for some reason, you know. Think around like 7 years clean, a health issue started to arise. I was born, and I thought this was like another one of the, my problems why I used really. I was born with my arms and legs out of their sockets, dislocated. And I had my arms put back when I was three, and my legs when I was seven. I was in a plaster cast from my chest to my ankles with my legs spread wide with an iron bar in between. And before that operation, I can remember how fearful I was, how the sort of noise of the other kids was sort of freaking me out. And they came in and stuck a pre-med in my arm. And it was like all that noise dissolved, you know. And I think when I was about, when I was up and running again, when I was about 13, when I started to use at school from a school teacher who took us round to his house to read American comics, which was all great fun, and gave us all sort of like maybe a marijuana to smoke. Something happened then. It was like that quietness descended upon me, that calm, and I could regulate my emotions, I could regulate my feelings, I could regulate my weight, all this other stuff. And so, almost like, you know, I became a sort of general, it's okay though, I'm just smoking dope every day. I became like that until it progressed, of course, until there was like, you know, no other place to go. And so, my beginnings came back because there was an unresolved issue. You know, I have a disease called Ehlers, which 1 in 100,000 people have, which affects the bones, where the bone is not bone. It's sort of sorry, I can't think of the word right now, but it means that in the long bones, particularly the hips and the arms, elbows, knees, cartilage, I get sort of like growths of cartilage as opposed to bone. So then began the big journey of recovery for me, which was to go through not one, not two, not three, but four hip replacements since the age of 7 years, since 7 years clean up to the last one, which I had was in 2013. And it's been the bane of my recovery, and it's also been where I've had to accept myself. I've had to accept that I needed to keep on growing, keep on, you know, accepting things, you know. I've had, you know, back operations as a result of the hips. The back will, you know, the load that your hips usually take, I can't, so my back gets affected. And you know, this was a sort of like unresolved thing that kept on. Also, when I came in, it was off the back of my parents and my sister's death. And this was just like something I could not go towards. I could not go there, you know. And one of the things that's happened in the last few years is that I've been able to sort of go in the grief, further than I've ever been able to before. You know, it's for some reason I've just had to keep the lid on this grief, and it's affected my relationships incredibly. It's affected my personal relationships. Marriages have broken, and it's taken me so long to realize the correlation between that incident and the rest of my life, even in recovery, with all the sort of like, you know, the trying to stay well and working the steps and doing the right thing and all this sort of stuff. You know, 5 years ago, for example, I almost relapsed. You know, I got to a place in a relationship and where I just couldn't do it anymore. And I couldn't say that, you know, because this relationship was supposed to work. I was in recovery, my wife was in recovery, you know, I had bags of time, she had bags of time. And, you know, we were almost like the, you know, the sort of like, this is what, you know, that's the people you want to be sort of thing, you know. And I bought into the whole deal. I bought into the whole thing of like covering up my problems with kind of wearing a t-shirt that said recovering nicely, you know. And at the same time, I was having these hip operations and then trying to get back on the horse as quick as I could with my work and all this stuff. And I was like completely exhausted and I was completely at my wit's end as how to make this work, you know. So I turned to an old sort of method, you know, for which there has been consequences of sabotage and all the rest of it. And so for the last 5 years, I've been trying to build up a life, a new life, if you like. And I was in such pain, you know, I really thought this is it, I can't take this. And, you know, I was in Brighton and I walked out to the sea and I thought, you know, it's, you know, this is the noble way to go and all this sort of stuff. And my phone went, I booked a session to see a therapist and they never got back to me. And my phone went just as I was walking in. It was that person who said, yeah, you wanted to see me. Well, if you want to come now, I'm free. And I called my sponsor and he said to me, okay, it's time to write down the three magic words, I am powerless, which is what I did. And I went through the steps again. This guy's been my sponsor for 30 years. He moved out. He moved and lives in Australia now. We decided to meet up in Hong Kong and do a fifth step there, which is absolutely amazing. And I sort of was able to sort of see and, you know, kind of accept and be accountable for things that I'd never been able to be accountable for before. You know, and I'd lived this life where I saw that throughout the inventory was a sort of default negative interpretation of what people say and do and how that impacts me in this sort of negative way all my life. You know, I always looked for this. I always listened for this. Look for the similarities, not the differences. I could not, you know, and a lot of it was bound up in who I am. I'm a person of mixed race. My dad was black from Jamaica. My mum was white from England. My sister, who was 11 years older than me, that was my family. Those are the people that were my mirrors in some way, and those are the people that died. And that, you know, I've had to sort of like grow up. I've had to grow up and sort of also accept certain things about the world, accept certain things about myself, and stop looking for outside validation, you know, and like get validation from the inside, you know, and become, which has been slowly happening to me, you know, becoming the person I thought I could be. Before it was like the power of addiction was just say, mate, don't even go there. Don't dream. Don't think that you can do this. Don't think that you can do that. And I've got to say, despite, you know, what's gone on, in the negative sense, you know, with all the operations and broken relationships and all that sort of stuff, there are things that happened to me which have been the stuff of dreams. You know, they have been the stuff of my wildest dreams, you know. And I'm a very much a work in progress, and slow, slow, and slow are the words that I adhere to, and they serve me well, a day at a time, you know. And something amazing that sort of I feel has only sort of become apparent in the last few years is that, like, I am best when I'm being of service. That's it, full stop. I don't even have to think why. I don't even have to sort of analyze it. I just know it, you know. And it's something that's sort of like, it's kind of obvious to me, but it's not obvious at all, you know. And it's like, and I mean service, you know, of course, you know, at meetings where I can, but to friends, family, loved ones, people, anybody, you know, put them first. Put them first instead of putting me first, you know. And I got some very great news. I'll finish on this the other week, you know, when I was trying to, you know, get myself into the place that I love, which is the arts, you know, music, film, all the rest of it. I went for this interview to university. I was like 18 years old, and I didn't get in. I was out of it. I crashed my dad's car the day. My work was complete shambles all over the place. So in recovery, I just like worked hard, you know, worked hard on my own. I've, you know, kept up the sort of passion and the desire and the love of this area of the world, you know. And just recently I got a call from the same university asking me if I would like to become a visiting professor. And I was just like blown away, because it's somewhere in there, you know. And it can, and it's, for me, it carries on the, you keep what you have by giving it away, you know. And I couldn't say no, you know. And the same thing, being of service, you know. If I can sort of, you know, carry something that I've got from the world of art, you know, one of my things is that art massages the suffering of the people who make it. That's for you, Penelope. No, but you know, and the people who are interested in that world, you know, I feel I do have something to give, you know. And that's a bonus. That's an outside recovery thing, you know. And I just want to sort of try and keep myself well. And of course. The world's in a very strange place at the moment. I'm sat in a room on my own, feeling like this movie I watched the other night, where I'm floating around space trying to get in contact with other people. But Steve, I've got to say thanks to you for asking me to do the chair. We will have that catch up, of course. And you know, everybody else that comes to these meetings, it's been invaluable to me so far. You know, I remember coming on at the start of the pandemic and just being able to read who was an addict, and that was about it. Because I was so kind of like, whoa, what the hell is this? So it's really nice to try and carry the message today, and I hope somebody got something from what I've shared today. Thank you very much.